All participants, please stand by. Your conference is ready to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the First Capital Realty Q4 2019 and year-end results conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to turn the conference over to Alison. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. In discussing our financial and operating performance and in responding to your questions during today's call, we may make forward-looking statements. These statements are based on our current estimates and assumptions, many of which are beyond our control, and are subject to a number of risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed or implied in these forward-looking statements. A summary of these underlying assumptions, risks, and uncertainties is contained in our various securities filings, including our MD&A for the year ended December 31st, 2019, and our current AIF, both of which are available on SEDAR and on our website. These forward-looking statements are made as of today's date, and except as required by securities law, we undertake no obligation to publicly update or revise any such statements. During today's call, we will also be referencing certain financial measures that are non-IFRS measures. These do not have standardized meanings prescribed by IFRS and should not be construed as alternatives. Management provides these measures as a complement to IFRS measures to aid in assessing the company's performance. These non-IFRS measures are further defined and discussed in our MD&A, which should be read in conjunction with this call. I'll now turn the call over to Adam.
Thank you very much, Alison. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us today for our year-end conference call. 2019 was a pivotal year for First Capital. To be successful, change has to be built on a solid foundation. FCR's evolution into an urban platform is not a recent phenomenon. It's evolved over the past decade plus. Today, as we celebrate our 20-year anniversary and start this new decade, our foundation is very solid. In 2019, we took several bold steps to unearth the true potential value of FCR. We launched our super urban strategy and a new brand identity that depicts the importance of community at the center of our real estate portfolio and solidifies our purpose to create thriving urban neighborhoods. We also addressed the Gazit overhang by facilitating an initial 1.2 billion dollar reduction of their ownership interest, including FCR acquiring 742 million dollars at a price well below our NAV. Gazit's ownership now stands at 4.4%, resulting in FCR being a widely held company for the first time. After a lot of work by our tax, accounting, and legal teams, we successfully completed our previously announced conversion to a real estate investment trust near year-end. Our focus on improving the people and culture side of our business came through loud and clear on our high engagement survey scores and led to FCR being named a top employer in Greater Toronto by The Globe and Mail for the first time. We were honored to be Canada's only public real estate company to receive this distinction in 2019. Our longstanding commitment as a leader in ESG garnered several accolades for our team, including receiving our third consecutive AAA ESG rating from MSCI. This is the highest rating possible. Perhaps most importantly were the advances we made executing our super urban strategy and in turn, enhancing the quality of our real estate portfolio. The composition of our portfolio underwent a significant shift in 2019 through 1.4 billion dollars of investment activity and over 9 million sq ft of zoning submissions, of which 6.5 million sq ft were in Toronto. This 1.4 billion dollars of investment activity included 835 million dollars of dispositions in our leased urban neighborhoods. We also had a very busy fourth quarter in which over half of our total dispositions closed, with the majority of the proceeds used to reduce debt following the temporary spike from our share buyback. By selling our entire portfolios in markets like Quebec City, Trois-Rivières, and Red Deer, we have almost no exposure to secondary markets, and in turn have increased our exposure to our most super urban positions, most notably those in Toronto. We continue to develop strong partnerships with FCR as the managing partner in portfolios that are urban, but not super urban. Roughly 20% of our properties, or 10% by value, fall into this partnership category now and growing. For example, Ottawa is a market we want to continue to participate in, but it lacks some of the super urban attributes that we look for. We now own a 50% interest in virtually all of our properties in Ottawa. It allows us to benefit from their future upside, enhance our returns through fee income, and grow together with our partners using less capital. We'll consider this for other markets and properties that we believe have further upside, but that lack super urban attributes we're targeting. Throughout 2019, we also invested. We invested over $550 million of capital into super urban neighborhoods, with roughly 85% of them in Toronto. Neighborhoods like Liberty Village, Yonge and Eglinton, and Yorkville, where we expanded our position and acquired a key development site adjacent to Yorkville Village and the Hazelton Hotel. All three of these Yorkville properties will benefit from being under FCR's common ownership. We're already seeing the impact of our recent investment activity on our key super urban metrics. Our average population density within 5 kilometers of our properties improved by 16%, from 250,000 people at the beginning of the year to 290,000 people today. We're confident that we will achieve our objective of 300,000 people sometime during 2020, which is ahead of schedule. Transit connectivity is also an important part of our real estate strategy. Over 99% of our portfolio is now within a 5-minute walk of public transit. I'll now make some comments on our density pipeline, which we believe is the most mispriced element of our company in the capital markets, so surfacing its value is a very important objective for our team. And we took meaningful steps in 2019 to progress this objective. First off, the pipeline grew. This is important because it's an indication of the relative upside inherent in our business through densification. It also protects the downside. We started the year with an existing portfolio of 23.9 million square feet of leasable area. We also had an identified incremental density pipeline of 22.5 million square feet, representing 94% of our existing portfolio at the time. These numbers are all at FCR's ownership share. Owing to dispositions, our existing portfolio actually shrunk to 20.9 million square feet by the end of the year. However, our density pipeline grew. It grew to 25 million square feet, now representing 120% of our built portfolio. Growing the pipeline is one thing, surfacing its value is another. An important initial step towards this is through the entitlement process. Heading into 2019, we had approximately 3.5 million square feet of our pipeline zoned. In 2019, we submitted new zoning entitlements for an additional 9 million square feet of density. As you'll hear from Kay, we have significantly enhanced our disclosure related to our density pipeline. The zoning submissions made in 2019 are detailed by property in this disclosure, as well as our current IFRS value for the group. By applying even the most conservative assumptions, it's clear that there is material value to be realized, including for the portion we have conservatively included in our IFRS NAV. While 2019 was no doubt our biggest year ever for zoning submissions, we are planning an additional 4 million square feet more in 2020, taking our 2-year total to roughly 13 million square feet. Our MD&A now provides insight into the individual properties that comprise our 25 million square foot density pipeline. It also highlights that certain properties haven't been included in our pipeline yet. Properties such as Pemberton Plaza in North Vancouver, or the 42 acres we own under Meadowvale Town Center in Mississauga, among many others. It's reasonable to assume that these properties will be densified in the future, but our vision and plans haven't evolved to the point of inclusion yet. So this is a future growth opportunity. Looking forward to 2020, we are very focused on unearthing the true value of SCR. As we pursue our super urban strategy, we come face to face with the paradox of a successful real estate strategy in the arena of the public markets. Quarterly metrics versus midterm and long-term value creation. We're well aware that selling our higher yielding properties to reduce debt pressures FFO initially. We're also well focused on the future value creation that our super urban strategy represents in the midterm. So we will strive to balance metrics like FFO over the short term as we surface the unrealized value in our 25 million square foot density pipeline, all of which is located in the strongest urban growth markets of Canada and have visible runway for continued and material NAV growth. Our management team is up to this challenge. We intend to deliver on our promise to delever, and until we do so, future investments will be aimed at enhancing properties which are core to our strategy. We'll continue our efforts to obtain additional entitlements, and we are ramping up our efforts to secure partnerships with partners who share our vision of creating thriving urban neighborhoods. The world is witnessing many new challenges, and the call for increased attention to ESG matters is increasing rapidly. Our super urban strategy meshes perfectly with increasing demands from stakeholders related to ESG. Creating a thriving urban neighborhood requires a different vision than managing traditional grocery-anchored shopping centers, one which is extremely well aligned with our approach to sustainability and will enable us to make even more progress in this area. Transit-oriented locations, parks, and public realm within our mixed-use developments, minimizing shadow impact and pedestrian-friendly projects are as important as our quest for LEED and BOMA BEST certifications. FCR is proud to have always taken a leadership position in sustainable practices, both for new and existing properties, and we're determined to maintain our leadership position. I want to conclude by acknowledging the incredible efforts of the FCR team in 2019. It was a tremendous year, and it's amazing to see how they have rallied behind our super urban strategy, our new REIT structure, and our new brand. Most importantly, our team has never been stronger, and I know they're up to the challenge of executing our new vision. I'll now pass things over to Kay, who will speak to our fourth quarter and annual results in more detail. Kay?
Thank you, Adam. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us on our call today. As Adam mentioned, it was a transformational and very busy year at FCR. We are quite pleased with all of the progress we made towards achieving our strategic objectives and the strong operating metrics we posted for the year. I would like to highlight some of the key strategic milestones and then take you through the results in more detail. Early in 2019, we introduced our super urban strategy and the metrics we use to measure our progress in advancing this strategy. These metrics include the average population density within a 5-kilometer radius of our properties, the proximity of our properties to transit, our portfolio's walkability score, growth in our average rental rate, increasing our density pipeline, and achieving our disposition targets. We made very good progress across all of these objectives in 2019. As Adam mentioned, our average population density reached 290,000 and is well on track to achieve our target of 300,000. Over 99% of our properties are now located within a 5-minute walk to public transit, up from our Q3 level of 90%. This improvement was primarily due to the Q4 dispositions of $468 million of properties that were inconsistent with our super urban strategy. Our portfolio's walkability score is 78, which is considered very walkable and where most errands can be accomplished on foot. Our average rental rate grew a record 5% in 2019, well above our five-year historical average growth rate of 2.4%. During the year, our density pipeline grew by 2.5 million square feet to 25 million square feet. Currently, 7.1 million square feet, or 28.4% of this density, up from 12.9% last year, is included in our NAV. 0.6 million square feet is included as part of our active developments, and the remaining 6.5 million square feet is valued at $506 million, or $78 per square foot. This is an increase of $349 million over the prior year, due primarily to acquisitions of property with meaningful incremental density potential, as well as entitlements received during the year. We include in this $506 million any vacant land parcels or properties we purchased for development, including properties like Christie Cookie, 1071 King Street West, 400 King Street West, Young and Roselawn, and 140 Yorkville. We also include land parcels adjacent to existing IPP centers, such as those at Plas Portobello and Plas VO. Zone density that is not encumbered by a lease, such as Phase 1 of Humbertown and Plas Panama, are also included. Plas Panama would be the largest property in terms of density that's included here, as it's zoned for 2 million square feet. Notwithstanding that these properties are currently included in our NAV, this does not mean that there is less upside here than in the rest of our pipeline. For example, our Christie Cookie asset, which is not yet zoned for our intended use, is included here at cost with an incremental density of only 300,000 square feet, which is based on the current in-place zoning versus the 3.5 million square feet we submitted for. Both of these numbers are at our 50% ownership interest in this asset. In April of 2019, we became a widely held company. This was accomplished via our repurchase of 36 million common shares from Gazit, combined with the closing of the secondary offering by Gazit for an additional 22 million shares. Upon closing of these transactions, Gazit's ownership in FCR declined from 33.3% to 9.9%, and since that time, Gazit has sold a portion of its remaining interest in FCR, reducing its current ownership to 4.4%. Following the share repurchase, we've been focused on reducing our leverage back to similar levels as at year-end 2018 through our disposition program. In 2019, we completed $835 million in dispositions and made good progress towards our deleveraging objective. One of our key strategic objectives for 2019 was converting from a corporation into a real estate investment trust, or a REIT. On December 30th, we successfully completed the conversion and began trading on the TSX under the symbol FCR.UN. As a result of the conversion, we expect to be included in the S&P TSX Capped REIT Index in March of this year. As part of our year-end reporting, we enhanced the disclosures around our density pipeline in our MD&A by including a breakdown of the density by urban market. We have also shown the individual list of properties where we have already submitted entitlement applications or plan to submit in 2020. These properties make up roughly 16 million of the 25 million square feet of incremental density within our portfolio. We have disclosed our active developments, as we always do, as well as a list of the additional properties that largely account for the remaining incremental density within our portfolio. As discussed previously, based on current market conditions, we expect to recognize meaningful increases to our IFRS values once approvals for these submissions are received. We have also highlighted properties with meaningful incremental density that are not at the stage where we would include them in our pipeline but are likely to be included at some point in the future. That summarizes the significant progress we made during 2019 in advancing our super urban strategy. Now turning to the financial results. On slide 6 of our conference call deck, which is available on our website in the investor section under earnings and reporting, we outline factors driving the year-over-year change in FFO. For 2019, we achieved FFO growth of 2% or 2 cents on a per unit basis. Excluding the costs related to our REIT conversion, FFO per diluted unit increased 3.3% over the prior year. Moving to slide 7, our same property NOI increased by 3% for the fourth quarter and 3.3% for the year, driven by rent escalations, higher occupancy levels, and higher lease surrender fees. On slide 8, we show our lease renewal activity. For the fourth consecutive quarter, we achieved double-digit increases on our lease renewal rates when comparing the rental rate in the last year of the expiring term to the first year of the renewal term. And for the seventh consecutive quarter, when comparing the rental rate in the last year of the expiring term to the average rental rate in the renewal term. Our total portfolio lease renewal lift for 2019 was a very solid 10.7% on 2.5 million square feet of renewals using the first year of the renewal term, and at 12.4% when using the average rental rate in the renewal term. Moving to slide 9, our average net rental rate grew a record 5% over the prior year to $21.25 per square foot. This growth was primarily due to renewal lifts, rent escalations, development completions, and dispositions of our leased urban properties. Our development completions for 2019 included 201,000 square feet of new commercial GLA and 247 residential units. The completions were primarily in our mixed-use King High Line project located in Liberty Village in Toronto. On slide 10, our total portfolio occupancy rate increased by 20 basis points over the prior year to 96.9%. Slide 11 highlights our 2019 development spend. The vast majority of this investment, totaling $166 million, was in super urban neighborhoods. Slide 12 shows the factors impacting FFO and the year-over-year changes. Slide 13 touches on our other gains, losses, and expenses, which are included in FFO. For the fourth quarter, we recognized $3.1 million of other expenses, primarily due to REIT conversion costs of $3 million. For 2019, we recognized $2.4 million in net other expenses, primarily due to REIT conversion costs, and transaction costs related to the Gazit secondary offering being partially offset by a $4 million gain on a prop tech investment and the additional proceeds we received from Target. Slide 14 summarizes our ACFO metric. During 2019, we generated $252 million in adjusted cash flow from operations. Slide 15 summarizes our 2019 financing activities. To fund the share repurchase transaction, we put in place $850 million of unsecured bank term loans in the first half of 2019 and repaid $100 million of these loans in the fourth quarter with proceeds from our disposition activities. Additionally, in July, we completed the issuance of $200 million of 7.5-year unsecured debentures with an interest rate of 3.5% and used the proceeds to repay other debt, including $150 million of maturing debentures with a much higher interest rate of 5.6%. Slide 16 summarizes the size of our operating credit facilities and our unencumbered asset pool, as well as our key financial ratios. At year-end, $7 billion, or 69% of our assets, were unencumbered, and we had approximately $800 million of availability under our revolving credit facilities. As previously stated, we have a goal to return our leverage metrics to similar levels as at year-end 2018 within 2 years of the share repurchase transaction. We made good progress in the quarter with debt to assets declining quarter over quarter from 48.9% to 46.7%, and debt to EBITDA declining from 10.8 times to 10.0 times. Our path to achieve our targets will show a steady decline in our debt to asset ratio. However, this will not be the case for debt to EBITDA, given EBITDA is calculated on a trailing 12-month basis and debt is at a point in time. We expect an uptick in this metric in the first half of 2020, but that it will remain below Q3 2019 levels, followed by a decline in the second half of the year to below Q4 2019 levels. Slide 17 shows our term debt ladder. Over the course of 2019, our weighted average interest rate declined from 4.2% to 4%. Looking forward to 2020, we expect same property NOI growth to be in the range of 2 to 3%. We expect our 2020 lease renewal lift to be in the range of 8 to 10%. We plan to invest between $150 million to $200 million in development, and we expect our development completions to be a similar amount at $150 to $200 million. We expect to take a small amount of space offline for development, approximately 40,000 square feet of GLA, primarily in phase two of our Wilderton project as construction continues. At the start of our disposition program, we stated we were targeting approximately $1.5 billion in dispositions. During 2019, we completed $835 million of dispositions. Based on the strategic acquisitions we made in Q3 2019, together with the success we've had thus far with our disposition program, and the fact that the remaining assets should garner even more interest, we expect to exceed our $1.5 billion target. As a result of the progress we made in 2019 against our disposition program and related deleveraging targets, our portfolio today has higher quality assets with increased density and stronger growth profiles and less downside risk, making it more desirable and more attractive than ever before. All of this is very positive, but in the short term, there is an impact to FFO. And as such, we do expect FFO to decline in 2020. Notwithstanding this, we do expect continued growth in NAV during the year and growth in FFO to resume in 2021. Overall, we are very pleased with the progress we made in 2019. It was a truly remarkable year for FCR, and I would like to congratulate and thank our entire team for their outstanding efforts and accomplishments during the year. We are very proud of all the milestones that our team achieved and look forward to executing on our strategy and objectives in the year ahead. At this time, we would be happy to answer any questions you have. Operator, can you please open the call for questions?
Thank you. We will now take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on the telephone keypad. If at any time you wish to cancel your question, please press the pound sign. Please press star 1 at this time. If you have a question, there will be a brief pause while the participants register. Thank you for your patience. The first question is from Mark Rothschild. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. In regard to your same property NOI, to what extent was that 3% impacted from asset sales that may have been a slower growth asset? And looking forward, you expect leasing spreads to accelerate them and be stronger in 2020 following the large number of asset sales?
Hi, Mark. Thanks for your questions. In 2019, there was very little impact on same property NOI from asset sales. So our view longer term is that, you know, the assets we're investing in have a better growth profile than the assets we're selling, although the assets we're selling do have a growth profile, just not as strong or compelling based on what we see over the longer term. But as you know, year to year, Sometimes things happen and you can't read too much into trends one year to the next. 2019 was an example of that. So there was actually very little impact on same property NOI based on assets moving buckets as a result of dispositions. Just so I'm clear on your second question, would you mind repeating it?
Yeah, in regard to leasing spreads that have been around the low double-digit range, would you expect that to be stronger in 2020 following the asset sales that you completed last year?
Yeah, again, it's hard to say in any one year, but, you know, Kay provided, soft guidance on kind of 8 to 10% expected for 2020. I can tell you the way our leasing group budgets, we've consistently exceeded what they have budgeted in terms of lease renewal lifts. We'll see if that's the case in 2020. So I would say, you know, we've seen an acceleration in the lifts on renewals over the past year. And so our expectation is that, you know, we continue to hang in at around that range.
Okay, great. Thanks. And my only other question in regards to the entitlements and, you know, the different tables on DNA and there's the $9 million that you submitted this past year. Can you maybe quantify somewhat on what would the value be in the market to the extent one of these assets would trade now on a buildable per foot on the residential side? And then how would that change pre and post entitlement?
Well, I mean, look, we've got a pretty wide range when you look at the properties that are included in that list. We have some density in South Surrey that's kind of at the low end of the range and, that would be mid-double digit values today. And then we've got, you know, density at the opposite end of the range that's in the neighborhood of $300 a buildable foot for that type of density. I'm talking residential density. The commercial is typically higher, but the residential density is the lion's share of it. So the reason we put this disclosure in, is, again, to support our objective of trying to surface some of this unrecognized value that we see in the pipeline. So we think that for stakeholders, they can take a look at this list. They can go into the actual submissions, which is public information, and they can form a view on, based on work that if they're prepared to do or the knowledge of the market, they can form a view on the rough value of, each of these properties and the density and how much density, is expected, and then compare that to the IFRS NAV. So our goal was to provide disclosure that can get people into a ballpark with an educated set of assumptions. So we obviously have our view. We got to be careful given these are zoning submissions, not completions. And so we're in some cases, in some circumstances, we're in sensitive discussions with stakeholders like the city and community. So we're reluctant to talk more about that at this stage, but we think we've provided the information that allows investors to get into the ballpark.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. The following question is from Dean Wilkinson. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
Adam, maybe just a follow-up on Mark's question. On the $6.5 million density that's currently valued at 506, that's 78 per square foot. Do you have a range of sort of the low and the high on where those density figures are? I mean, you've seen some numbers sort of, you know, core GTA where you might be pushing as high as $200 per square foot for some of these. And just trying to get a sense of the range of that in looking at the $9 million that's sort of in the hopper.
Yeah, I mean, GTA, you could say $200. Toronto proper, which is where the majority of this is located, in many of these neighborhoods, it's well north of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very tough to put a specific value on it. And again, we've tried to lay it out. The one thing that I think is very important to flag is that because it's included in our IFRS NAV does not mean that we've taken a market value for the density and applied it by the expected density. In fact, the majority of it is carried at our cost.
Right.
But if we buy a piece of land, you know, Christie Cookie is a great example. It's sitting in our IFRS NAV, but it's sitting at our IFRS NAV at our cost. And the density that's been included in the NAV is the in-place zone density, which is about 300,000 square feet at FCR share. So I want to make it very clear that while it's included in our IFRS NAV, that should not be directly linked to the expected zone value. So, in fact, there are some properties that are included in our IFRS NAV that on successful zoning, we think will have more of an increase in value than some of the properties that aren't even included in the NAV. So I think it's an important distinction. Our policy on how we value this density and when it gets included in the pipeline, when it gets included in IFRS NAV, I would say, you know, given the options is more on the conservative side. And so until we have a lot of clarity around the zoning that will be achieved, I would say there's a pretty big gap between what it's carried at on our balance sheet, if it's carried at all, and what that value is.
And then in terms of the process of that markup, so as soon as you've got sort of the entitlement and the approval in hand, do you then go back and look at, okay, so now we'll put a value per square foot on those buildable approved footages, or is it in reference to the market? Okay.
That's what we do. And in some cases, like in the case of 400 King Street, we reached a settlement with City Council. And so, in our view, we've now removed the rezoning risk. And so that did trigger a write-up that the formal rezoning will take place sometime in the next couple of months, Jody, in March. Okay. So technically it's not rezoned, but from a practical perspective, We have a settlement with the city on what the zoning will be, and so that was good enough for us to have our appraiser factor that into the valuation, and that triggered a write-up.
Got it. And can you remind us, when you get those approvals and you get that write-up in place, is there an increased component of carry vis-a-vis a tax assessment or anything to that effect, or it's just a valuation exercise?
Yeah, it's just a valuation exercise. I mean, it depends on the municipality. Some will charge your taxes on the highest and best use, whether you've pursued a path of rezoning to that use or not, and others. So it depends on the municipality, but typically there is not a correlation between carrying cost tax assessment versus, when we include it in our IFRS NAV or when we write things up based on rezoning progress.
Got it. And then in terms of how you're looking at those, the debt metrics, have you incorporated any of this forward view of that zoning, or would that tend to sort of, be accretive to your debt measures, at least on a book value basis as they come in?
Yeah, fortunately, the majority of this density is in Toronto. Unfortunately, there's a bit of a backlog in the city getting the zoning done. So, our expectation is that the rezoning for the majority of this density will be achieved past the initial milestone date that we set, which was 2 years from last April. So we have not baked that in. But if we fast forward past that time period, our expectation is that some of this density will get developed by us. Some of it will sell a partial interest to a strategic partner and co-develop, and some of it I would expect we will sell outright. And so obviously the sale of outright air rights is very positive for debt metrics with little to no earnings accretion. So that bodes very well for, starting to look at 2021, 2022, 2023, but we haven't factored it into what we've been talking to the market about in terms of our shorter term debt metric objectives.
Okay, great. And then just a final small housekeeping for me. Looking at the Montreal assets, looks like the counter to maybe the rest of your markets, the average rents in place there went down a tick from last year. Was there a big lease renewal or something that happened in there, or was that sale of assets that would have driven that difference?
The only thing that we didn't have rents go down in Montreal. We sold assets, but the assets we sold had a lower average rent than what we hung on to. So, Maybe we take this offline, Dean, and you can show us what you're looking at, and we'll help walk through it.
It's a disclosure on page 8, that second line item. So that'd be great.
We'll take a look at it right after this and get back to you.
Sounds good. I will hand it back. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The following question is from Yuan Rodriguez. Please go ahead.
Hi. A couple clarifications. That the $506 million, or rather the 6.5 million square feet, that's made up of all of the pre-2019 entitlements and some portion of the 2019, or?
Hi, Johan. Johan, it's Kay. In terms of what I said in my script, I'll just kind of go back to that. So any vacant land parcel or property that we purchased for redevelopment is included in that $506 million. So that's certainly a portion of it. And I referenced some assets like Christy Cookie, 1071 King Street West, Young and Roselawn, 140 Yorkville. So that's one component. Excess land parcels adjacent to IPP centers, that's another component because we've got to value those land parcels at something. They're valued separately than the IPP centers. And I mentioned Plas Portobello, Plas VO as both having examples of that. And then the third one would be the zone density. And so I mentioned phase one of Humbertown and Plas Panama. Both of those are unencumbered by leases, so they would be included in this number.
Okay, so on the pre-2019 entitlement applications, you've got 8 properties there. Only the first two, Panama and Humbertown, are included in that figure, and then the remaining 6 are not?
The majority would be included there because they are zoned as referenced in the table above. Not all of these are zoned, so something like Appleby Village is one of the properties that's not zoned, so it would not be included at this stage.
Okay, that's helpful. And then I just want to make sure I heard you guys correctly. In terms of the $1.5 billion you mentioned at the end that you expected to exceed that total, was that because you expect better pricing on the sales or you plan on selling additional properties?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah, both. I mean, part of it is when we set the $1.5 billion target, that was strictly related to getting our leverage back to where it was. With little expected in the way of acquisitions, and then a couple of very strategic ones materialized in Q3, which you would have seen. And so part of it is an uptick from that. Part of it is, you know, our conviction in the ability to continue to execute because, you know, if you say we're half done the first half in terms of assets, depth of, the market for buyers, pricing, et cetera. The first half is expected to be tougher than the second half, just given the quality of the assets and the way the environment is and where there's capital and demand for the types of different properties in the various markets. So it's a combination of the acquisitions we did, which kind of required that to go up a bit, slightly better pricing expected, and that's the main reason.
And then the soft guidance of 2-3% same property NOI, is that stable same property NOI or does that include development?
As you know, if there's development of any consequence, it's not included in same property at all. So that other bucket that you're referring to, is the one we look at. And in some cases, it's, you know, we end up demolishing space. So we see development trigger a reduction in the leasable area. So if there's any development of any consequence, the property's not in same property period in any bucket. So but we look at total same property. That's the reference it's been made to.
Okay. I'll turn it back.
Okay. Thanks, Johan.
Thank you. The following question is from Sam Damiani. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Everyone, just on the FFO guidance, aside from being, you know, down a little bit year over year in 2020, can you be a little more specific on the quantity? We're talking 1 to 2 cents, 3 to 4 cents.
Well, look, I'm sure Kay wants to jump in on this one, but before she does, you know, we sold $835 million of real estate this year. The majority, not all, but the majority is IPP. You know, I would describe this as the bottom of our portfolio. I hate using that word because most of this real estate is actually good real estate. But the average cap rate was about 6%. Okay, so, I mean, if you just run the simple math on the spread between the 6% and the cost of debt, you can get into a certain level of dilution, you know, pretty quickly. So I think that's an important starting point. Okay.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in. So within the MD&A, we've made disclosure on the NOI loss from dispositions, the NOI from acquisitions. We show you development completions. We show you development yield. We've given you soft guidance on same property NOI growth. And you know there's an impact from the weighted average unit change given the share repurchase transaction. I think if you triangulate on that data, you can come very close to coming up with a good estimate for FFO next year.
That's why they pay us big bucks.
Yeah. Very big bucks.
But, yeah, well, that's another matter. But I guess when we look at dispositions, I mean, $800 million last year, that's a pretty fulsome pace. Do you see continuing that level in 2020, or perhaps transacting a little more slowly in the near term?
Look, at this stage, we're still early in the year, but I would say that based on what we see now, we think it's likely we come in the same type of neighborhood. The assets are a little better that we're looking to divest of. There's going to be more partial interests than there were last year, which actually makes it easier for us. We actually have a number of institutional investors that are much more keen to buy partial interest with us as their partner than 100% interest. And the environment in general, there appears to be more capital looking for investment in the type of real estate that we'd be looking to divest than there was last year at this time. So based on what we see now, it's likely to be a similarly active year in 2020, which works well for us because there's a clear relationship between the level of dispositions we do and the deleveraging. And, you know, we're confident that especially based on the assets we sell, that the dilution to earnings from selling these properties, given the growth profile of the business on what remains, we think we should get adequate multiple expansion to offset that.
Okay, that's helpful. And the added disclosure this quarter is very helpful, so thank you for that. And just to finish off, on the $506 million, back to that, you know, the handful of properties that you mentioned, you know, most of which were in Toronto, and the only one, it seems, that actually has or effectively has its zoning in place is 400 King. So, is it fair to say
that's actually the one that doesn't have that one we expect will have its full zoning in March. Appleby Village does not have zoning yet. We expect that relatively soon. But the rest do. So Panama zoning's in place, Humbertown's in place, Wilderton is in place, Long Street actually is not in place, and then the last two, Rutherford and 200 West Esplanade, are in place.
Okay, I was actually referring to, I think it was Kay mentioned a handful of properties in that bucket, being Christie Cookie, 1071 King, Florida King, Young and Roselawn, 140 Yorkville.
Okay, so this is the group of properties that we submitted for in 2019.
Okay. And sorry, those are 506, isn't that right?
That's correct. And some of those are recent acquisitions. So you take 140 Yorkville.
Yes.
It would be included at the cost we acquired it at.
Right. And what square footage would you have for that asset? Because you don't have the...
Christie?
No, for 140 Yorkville.
Well, 140 Yorkville, it actually technically is zoned. We're looking for a rezoning to change things. So what we would have adopted is the zoning that's in place.
Okay. Because $78 a foot does seem on the low side for, you know, most of the properties that you mentioned. So I just wanted to...
Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, this is why we wanted to put the disclosure out, because... just because we say it's in our IFRS NAV doesn't mean there's not a lot of value to be realized on rezoning. So, obviously 140 Yorkville is in our NAV at a higher number than $78 a foot.
Yeah.
You know, but when you look at the group, and, you know, that's why it was important for us to put this out, and you use reasonable assumptions, it's clear that there's a lot of value to be realized on rezoning. So we're not telling you the $78 a foot is current market value. We're trying to give you a data point that, you know, people can make assumptions on and, you know, basically get into a ballpark on what is expected in terms of value creation on the full successful zoning of these properties.
Okay. Just finally, then I'll turn it back, is on the list of 2019 applications, you know, which are the first one or two larger properties where you expect to receive approval?
Hi, Sam. It's Jody. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jody.
So, hi. So, we submitted for 13 applications in 2019. The ones that are, I think, more advanced than the others, 1071 King is pretty well advanced, so we expect to see complete itself very soon. Following that, I'd say Yonge and Roselawn, it would be the next one that should happen. Then over in Montreal, Plaza Bay-Jersey, will come later on as well. So I'm sort of giving you a general idea of what we expect to happen. 1071 King and Yonge Roselawn being, I'd say, the very next wave that will come through. And then following that, we have things like Semiahmoo, Royal Orchard, 801 York Mills in Toronto that will come following. I'd say further down the list, Christie Cookie is a big process, as you know, and so and we submitted official plan application last year. 2020 will be the Christie Cookie zoning submission, and so we have a big process for there. So that's a bit further down the line. But the rest of them are, you know, over the next 12 months, we should see some of these early ones come through.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.